you know, dispensing, you know, medicines in Africa, and but it was also the agency in which that funded democracy promotion programs, and these were all when the National Endowment for Democracy, which operates under AID, was founded in 1983 under the Reagan administration. The first director of it said, "We do in the open what the CIA used to do covertly," meaning that they fund oppositional groups and in countries that are out and out, you know, dissenting from U.S. hegemony, say Bolivia. You fund these organizations that basically raise the alarm that the country is heading toward dictatorship, and it manipulates the press. I mean, you know, in Bolivia, the reason why that coup didn't take hold is because Evo Morales kicked out AID.
And you also have, for example, Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive saying among the most infamous examples of USAID funding was the Office of Public Safety, a USAID police training program in the Southern Cone that also trained torturers. We only have 20 seconds. It's not your total focus, but your thoughts on how it's been used.
I mean, I don't have doubt that it's been used that way. I have no evidence of that. It's certainly in the conversation in South Africa, for example. People would make those accusations and be frustrated about that. But I'm more interested in the way that this kind of agency shuts down South Africa's ability to solve its own problems. And
I think that is key, and we're going to link to the articles you write, Professor Catherine Mathers at Duke University. Thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive. Saturday, April 5th, Canada's Reggae Ambassadors, the Human Rights, invites you to join us as we celebrate the release of our new album, One People, at the Hotel Wolf Island. Tickets are $25 advance at thehotelwolfisland.com, $30 at the door. Show starts at 7:30, and we'll be playing two full sets. Check out the Human Rights.
They've sold millions of albums, performed on six continents, on the world's greatest stages. And now, coming to Kingston, Grand On Stage presents Pink Martini.
Je ne veux pas travailler, non.
Celebrating their 30th anniversary, featuring award-winning vocalist China Forbes. Pink Martini, Saturday, March 22nd at Kingston Grand Theater. Tickets for Pink Martini and the rest of the Grand On Stage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
Wolf Island and Kingston Massive. Saturday, April 5th, Canada's Reggae Ambassadors, the Human Rights, invites you to join us as we celebrate the release of our new album, One People, at the Hotel Wolf Island. Tickets are $25 advance at thehotelwolfisland.com, $30 at the door. Show starts at 7:30, and we'll be playing two full sets. Check out thehumanrights.ca for more info. That's the Human Rights One People album release party, Saturday, April 5th at the Hotel Wolf Island, right by the ferry docks. Presented in association with CFRC 101.9 FM.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will cover anti-Palestinian racism and what are its characteristics. A new initiative in Canada is trying to have a clear definition of this type of racism be recognized officially by the Canadian government. We will learn more about this initiative, the reasons behind it, and why anti-Palestinian racism shouldn't be conflated with Islamophobia in general. One of the characteristics of this type of racism is the erasure of the history of Palestinians. But in the second part of the show, we will learn how even the simple display of emotions by Palestinians is constantly erased and vilified by the media. Stay tuned.
It's
anti-Palestinian racism and how we experience it here is an extension of what is happening in Palestine. The illegal occupation, apartheid, settler colonialism, genocide, these are all inherently racist structures that Palestinians are living under and resisting. Post-October 2023, the reprisals were open. People told you why you were being fired. It was because of your support of Palestinian human rights. They were that explicit. In some cases, it was much more extreme than that. Very derogatory terms used against Palestinians were also expressed in those disciplinary measures. It wasn't a whisper campaign that got people fired. It was very overt actions that made it very clear a person was being disciplined or not getting jobs or, you know, were having their artwork censored because of Palestine.
Welcome to the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. We discuss all things related to Palestine and examine how they intersect with the political landscape here in Canada and beyond. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. There has been an unprecedented eightfold increase in anti-Palestinian racism in Canada since the start of the genocide in Gaza on October 7, 2023. Details of which is discussed in the Anti-Palestinian Racism in Canada 2023 annual report published by the CJPME Foundation late last year. You can find the report in the description. Despite this surge, anti-Palestinian racism, or APR, has faced significant pushback from the Canadian government, initially excluded from its anti-racism strategy and later considered without reference to the Nakba. Nearly every mainstream media outlet has played a role in perpetuating APR, whether through biased coverage of Palestine-Israel, widespread anti-Palestinian rhetoric among commentators, or the framing of Palestinian rights advocacy as anti-Semitic. Understanding anti-Palestinian racism is crucial, and its real-world consequences include job loss for voicing support of Palestinians, the justification of violence against Palestinians and their allies, and police using disproportionate force against peaceful protesters. To help us understand APR more, its definitions, implication, importance of connection to the Nakba, and how it evolved after October 7, I'm joined by lawyer Dania Majid, co-founder and president of the Arab Canadian Lawyers Association, also known for defining APR in her 2022 publication, Anti-Palestinian Racism, Naming, Framing and Manifestations. She's also the artistic director of the Toronto Palestinian Film Festival. Dania, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how would you define APR briefly? I've read it. It's a big, broad, beautiful definition. But for our listeners who are being introduced to it,
yeah, very briefly, anti-Palestinian racism is a distinct form of racism that aims to silence, erase, and dehumanize Palestinians and their narratives. And it can impact both Palestinians and non-Palestinian advocates of Palestine. And as we outline in the report, there are numerous manifestations of anti-Palestinian racism, but its objective is to protect and uphold the settler colonialism and apartheid of Palestine.
And why is it important to identify APR as a distinct form of anti-Arab racism and Islamophobia?
Well, it is important because right now what we have been seeing is a lot of conflation between anti-Palestinian racism and Islamophobia in particular. And that conflation actually is harmful to us because it erases the Palestinian experience, the unique experience of how we explain our experience and understand anti-Palestinian racism. So absolutely, there is intersectionality between these forms of racism. However, when they are conflated, then we don't, you know, tackle or understand or address the roots and the drivers of this form of racism. And as a result, then, that form of racism is allowed to persist. So, for example, in Ottawa, we heard of the story of the hijab-wearing Palestinian woman who was attacked by an Israeli supporter while she was chanting from the river to the sea at a protest. Now, based on the published facts of this case, if the attacker had seen this woman wearing a hijab and walking down the street on any other day, she probably wouldn't have attacked her or pulled off her hijab. But the particular trigger for this attack was the fact that this woman was publicly expressing support for Palestine. And this makes it textbook anti-Palestinian racism, not Islamophobia. And she may still have been, would have been attacked whether or not she was wearing the hijab or not. What we do see, among people who are filing complaints around anti-Palestinian racism, we see an attempt to try to conflate Islamophobia and anti-Palestinian racism as a way by institutions to avoid addressing the anti-Palestinian racism complaint directly. But they are clearly different. Islamophobia describes the hatred against the Islamic faith and the Muslim people, whereas anti-Palestinian racism targets in a different way those who are Palestinian or those who advocate for Palestinian rights in order to suppress any criticism of Israel's decade-long apartheid and occupation of Palestinian land and people. The other component is, you know, when we conflate the two, it falsely suggests that the violence in Palestine, Israel, is a religious conflict in order to misdirect the understanding of the oppression as one being rooted in settler colonialism. Also, the conflation perpetuates this racism because it then erases key components and diversity of Palestinian identity and people, history, and narratives. Because, as you know, Palestinians follow many faiths, including being Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Druze, and many others, or no faith at all. And then again, by conflating the two, then there's no naming or acknowledgement of this racist experience, and therefore no resources or efforts are directed towards addressing anti-Palestinian racism. And it is, it's seen to be accepted in or just allowed to persist.
There seems to be a lot of resistance in Canada about APR, and I do have my two cents on why that is, but I want to hear from you. Why do you think that is?
Well, I would maybe rephrase that. I actually don't think there's been a lot of resistance to APR in Canada, because what we have seen is when we released the report, and first the report was done in, with extensive consultations. You know, we consulted with people in Canada, the US, Europe, and Palestine. We talked to those who are Palestinian and, doing this activist or advocacy work. And we talked to our allies as well, who are also part of the movement, lawyers, scholars, academics. And all this work was put in to create the framework. Once the framework was released, it's not like we took a lobbying approach. It was put into the world, and if it was accepted, we thought it will organically grow, and if it wasn't accepted, it would just become another report for the shelf. And what we did see is, once we released it, is that it grew organically by those who are directly impacted by anti-Palestinian racism. So we have seen doctors, educators, students, employees, unions, even politicians, all talking about anti-Palestinian racism and wanting to address it in their context or having to grapple with it. And we started seeing it being adopted, whether it be the term in anti-racism strategies or in some cases the definition as a whole. And it's been really interesting to see the trajectory increase, especially in the last year, of the use and acceptance of and recognition of anti-Palestinian racism. So we haven't seen resistance. In fact, we've seen really broad-based acceptance. Where the pushback does come from is from the pro-Israel groups who, for their own reasons, do not want to see, Palestinians expressing their lived experiences or even challenging them. And challenging the attacks and reprisals that they face. And the other place where we see some resistance is around the definition itself. And most of the definition or the description that we have in the framework, has been pretty much accepted. Where we see the pushback coming from the pro-Israel groups and the government is around the phrase Nakba denial. And this is where we then see institutions push back and wanting to see that phrase removed from the description. And thus far, the community has strongly signaled to us that it must remain in there.
Okay, because I've seen a couple of videos, and I do the monitoring in Parliament, and there was the incident that happened some 3-4 months ago when Nikki Ashton was asking Kamala Kerr,
yeah,
and she kept dodging the question.
Yes, we see dodging, but as we even saw from the government, for instance.
But she didn't give an answer. There were yes and no answers, and she was giving, you know.
Yes, and this is where the political play and, you know, politics are being weighed. Election is impending. They're weighing, you know, the stakes of being forthcoming or not on anti-Palestinian racism. But we have seen two, I would say, important developments. The first is within the Canadian anti-racism strategy is the recognition that Palestinians face unprecedented levels of hate. I mean, with that acknowledgement, what could that be other than anti-Palestinian racism? And this is, you know, noted in three spots within the Canadian anti-racism strategy. And I would say is that acceptance of anti-Palestinian racism that Palestinians experience, even if they did not use that terminology. The other recent development is that we saw a readout from Amira Al-Khawabi and her meeting with Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, in that he recognized anti-Palestinian racism and that there should be a need or there should be a definition to accompany you know, that the government would work on a definition or include or incorporate a definition. That work is ongoing. So we will have to wait and see what comes of it, especially now that we know that an election is impending. So it's not like the government itself has fully dismissed anti-Palestinian racism. They are trying to weigh at this point how it will be recognized and if it will be defined, and if it's defined, what definition they will use. And right now, the sticking point is around Nakba denial.
And why is that?
There's a lot of pushback on Nakba denial from the pro-Israel community. They do not want Palestinian Canadians to talk about the Nakba. In the same way that the Palestinians in Palestine, Israel, are not to talk or mark the Nakba. Even though we have seen politicians themselves invoke the Nakba during the course of the genocide, talking about bringing another Nakba, you know, to Palestinians. So they will use the phrase Nakba to equate genocide when they're trying to incite a genocide. But for Palestinians and even, you know, Israeli allies in Palestine, Israel, they cannot commemorate the Nakba. In Canada, we see a lot of this similar rhetoric play out here. And what the pro-Israel community states, which is really completely irrational, is that by acknowledging Nakba or Nakba denial is equivalent to downplaying the Holocaust. And these are two separate historical events, and you can talk about both without undermining the other. What is dangerous and in that is that they're trying to suggest, you know, by talking about the Nakba, or, you know, trying to make that linkage between the Nakba and Holocaust, that by talking about the Nakba, we're trying to undermine the use of the Holocaust as justification for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And as we know in international law, there can be no justification for genocide or ethnic cleansing. One atrocity does not give permission to commit another atrocity.
Because the way I saw it is that acknowledging the Nakba potentially challenges the legality of the State of Israel. The establishment of the State of Israel came,
yes,
you know, because of the Nakba. So when you acknowledge that the Nakba happened and the Nakba is illegal, that can invite the question that the Israeli state is illegal.
I mean,
that's in very simple terms, no?
Ultimately, that's part of the narrative, right? In that the Holocaust was used to justify the Nakba and therefore the creation of the State of Israel. And this is why the Nakba and the Holocaust have been tied together. At the end of the day, the state has been created, you know, and it was, you know, through I would say problematic means, through the United Nations and even the, you know, question the legalities of the Balfour Declaration. But nonetheless, the Nakba happened, and it has a pivotal impact on Palestinians intergenerationally. And to deny Palestinians from talking about it or expressing any discourse, narratives, culture, whatever it may be, expression on the Nakba is a form of anti-Palestinian racism. It does not negate the experiences of the Holocaust, and you can't use the Holocaust to justify the carrying out of the Nakba, just as you cannot use October 7th to justify carrying out a genocide.
So it's very interesting on two fronts. On one front, I think as a Palestinian, I don't make the link to the Holocaust. There is no link between the Holocaust and the Nakba, but there is a direct link between the Nakba and the establishment of the State of Israel. And it's interesting to note that whenever we bring up the Nakba and the importance of the Nakba in the definition, their mind goes to Holocaust, although that's not what we're referring to.
Absolutely.
Like you said, they are independent as instances.
Yeah.
And then the other thought that came to mind was allowing them not to include the Nakba in the definition is something that they can build on and they're doing right now, which is denying the genocide that happened. And we've seen that in several instances in the past week alone. One of them was CBC, when Natasha Fateh said, whatever it is called.
Yeah.
You know, it's, yeah. And then there was also the Ben Maroney and on his show said, I won't talk to people who say there's a genocide and flat earther.
Yeah.
So I think there's also that extrapolation that, you know, if we can deny the Nakba, we can deny the genocide.
Yeah. Like, you are right that only the pro-Israel community invokes or has made this connection. We have not made that connection. And you know, when I first saw that connection in an article about how talking about the Nakba is equated to downplaying the Holocaust, and we have to remember downplaying the Holocaust or undermining the Holocaust, that's a provision in the criminal code. So it is concerning to us about that, you know, about that connection being made. I was really surprised, you know, because in my mind, these were two separate events, two separate atrocities. So yes, the Nakba for us is tied to, as you said, the creation of the State of Israel. But it does not flow from the Holocaust. The Holocaust, you know, by some is being used as the justification for why the Nakba as an atrocity was committed, in the same way that October 7th is being used to justify the genocide. And talking about genocide denial, I mean, we have to remember that the Nakba is not, it refers to events in 1948, but as Palestinians, we talk about the Nakba as an ongoing event. It has not ended. We talk about it as the ongoing Nakba. So, and that includes the genocide as being a part of this Nakba. And you will hear that from people in Gaza, Nakba survivors in Gaza, who said, I'm living through another Nakba. You hear that from the genocide incitement of politicians similar to Smotrich and Ben-Gavir, saying we're going to bring or unleash another Nakba on you. So the Nakba has been used to invoke images or descriptions of genocide. So the genocide denial is part of, you know, is sort of implicitly part of the Nakba denial, as it is, you know, talking about dehumanizing Palestinians, which was used, the dehumanization is used to, you know, manufacture consensus around committing a genocide. And this is the terminology about Palestinians being animals or all terrorists, lumping everyone in Gaza as a terrorist, even babies we have seen described as future terrorists in order to justify their murder. So the genocide piece does come in through different aspects of the framework. And so it is, you know, you can't take it out of the Nakba. And this is why, and again, the definition talks about Nakba denial specifically. This is why, you know, reference to Nakba denial was so important to the Palestinian community. And it was something that came out of the consultations, that it was critical that Nakba denial be explicitly recognized and not just obfuscated under, you know, another category around silencing and erasing and exclusion, but it be actually Nakba denial be named specifically. And that's why we included it. And this is why it's such a problem when there are attempts to water down the definition to make it more palatable by removing that term. In doing so, it becomes a form of anti-Palestinian racism in and of itself.
100%. But if given a choice between a definition without the Nakba or no definition at all, it's a tough choice, but would you go for no definition at all?
This is something I have thought a lot about, and we have spoken to, you know, again, Palestinians who are doing this work, you know, directly impacted. And it's been unanimous from the community, from experts, from scholars, you name it, that any framework around anti-Palestinian racism must include Nakba denial, because it's already in there. So the act of removing it should be rejected. The community has instructed us not to accept any, you know, a watering down of the anti-Palestinian racism framework that we put out, and to ensure that Nakba denial remains. And so we are proceeding on that path.
Yeah. I mean, that's what defines what Palestinian is. If there's no Nakba, there was no.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the whole premise, no?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important, and this sometimes get lost. Anti-Palestinian racism and how we experience it here is an extension of what is happening in Palestine. The illegal occupation, apartheid, settler colonialism, genocide, these are all inherently racist structures that Palestinians are living under and resisting. Now, and so they, you know, so they live the most extreme form of anti-Palestinian racism. In the West, we experience that anti-Palestinian racism as an extension of what's happening in Palestine, because when we speak out against the occupation, settler colonialism, apartheid, and genocide, because we get attacked in order to ensure that those structures remain in place, are protected from and shielded from criticism. So you can draw a line between what is happening in Palestine to how we experienced it in Canada. You know, the reprisals, the censorship, the erasing, not as extreme as what is happening to Palestinians, but it is an extension. That experience is an extension of what is happening in Palestine in order to uphold, you know, the illegal occupation and apartheid of Palestinians. So we can't do work on anti-Palestinian racism or, you know, talk about anti-Palestinian racism without acknowledging the roots, where it comes from, and why the objective of anti-Palestinian racism and why we do experience it. And ultimately, it is to protect and uphold these racist structures against Palestinians.
Has the APR strategy been developed as a response to IRA, or is it related to the development of IRA in any way?
I mean, if you want to, like, just to lay to rest that APR has nothing to do with IRA. I mean, that there's zero connection between anti-Palestinian racism and IRA. They have one approach, which is weaponizing anti-Semitism against Palestinians. Anti-Palestinian racism is about naming our experiences of racism for the reason to protect us from those attacks and those reprisals. It is not about attacking another community. It's not about trying to silence discourse and telling others what they can and cannot say, but it is a way to, you know, name and validate the experience that we collectively experience as Palestinians and those who advocate for Palestinians in order to protect ourselves from those attacks that we have experienced doing this work for, you know, decades and decades. When we did this work, you know, IRA was not in the forefront. It was not the root of this work or the trigger for this work. That was really very much sparked by the Dr. Azarova scandal at the University of Toronto, the hiring scandal at the law school there. And, you know, ensuring that, you know, we name that experience as opposed to try to make it one of a dispute under international law or trying to validate her positions under international law. We wanted to ask the question, why was she being attacked in the first place? Why are many others like her being attacked in the first place? And that's because there is a concerted attempt to silence all discourse, all pro-Palestine discourse or discourse that upholds Palestinian human rights in academic settings and other settings. And we really wanted to get at the root and not treat this as a intellectual dispute or, you know, disagreement on politics or any other sort of frame that has been put around similar acts of reprisals in the past. This is very much the structure of, you know, silencing anything around Palestine. That is, it's an experience that we feel and have experienced collectively, and we've been experiencing it for generations.
Are the cases that are being presented currently under APR different from one another? Is there any change in the type of APR cases, or are they just more frequent.
And are you I'm assuming you're referring between present time, pre and post October 2023?
Of course. Yeah.
So
well, in general, that specifically.
Yeah. So the cases have been similar in many respects in terms of the manifestations and how we've been seeing APR expressed. The difference present time that we have noticed is very much the frequency. We have seen an unprecedented level of anti-Palestinian racism. But that frequency might be also impacted by the fact that, that we now have a framework to name that experience that we have been collectively experiencing, whereas before we didn't. Because there's been so much collective action happening around Palestine, and so many of us have experienced anti-Palestinian racism. The isolation, the piece around isolation and the chilling effect that comes with it has been ironically removed. So people don't feel the same, and because we have the framework as well, people don't have the same fear and shame when they have experienced an act of anti-Palestinian racism. They have been much more public in terms of, talking about what has happened to them, whether it be in the workplace, in art institutions, cultural institutions, universities. So we're getting more, we're hearing more about these cases than we have in the past. The other piece that we have noticed that is distinct this time around is that the racism that expressed has been very overt. In the past, and as we saw with the Dr. Azarova case, it was very much more of a whisper campaign where things were done behind someone's back and you never really knew if anti-Palestinian racism was at play. You suspected it. You knew in your gut that it was, but you didn't have the smoking gun to say, okay, this is why I was fired. This is why I didn't get the job or the interview or whatever. Dr. Azarova's case was very unique in the sense that we had whistleblowers who critically, provided that evidence that allowed that, that sparked this work. And when the Arab Lawyers Association went and filed a judicial review, we then got the legal disclosure. So we had all the emails and we saw that anatomy of a whisper campaign and how it played out. Post October 2023, the reprisals were open. People told you why you were being fired. It was because of your support of Palestinian human rights. They were that explicit. In some cases, it was much more extreme than that, where, very derogatory terms used against Palestinians were also expressed in, those disciplinary measures. So it wasn't a whisper campaign that got people fired. It was very overt actions that made it very clear a person was not, was being disciplined or not getting jobs or, were having their artwork censored because of Palestine. And this is something very unique in anti-racism work, because usually the most difficult piece around anti-racism work is making that connection that whatever happened to you was a result of racism. Where in this moment, for Palestinians and their allies, it was very explicit that you were being targeted because of your work on Palestine or your advocacy on Palestine. The other piece that we have noticed in this time is that these reprisals were for things that were very minor. Posting a Ceasefire Now logo on your Instagram, sharing Human Rights Watch reports. These were very low bar type of actions, but employers and other institutions still took action and took very severe punitive measures against that person. So again, the intensity of the reprisals has very much increased in this time round. And lastly, I would say one of the new factors in terms of the form of reprisals is in this period of time, unlike, prior period of time, we have seen an intensification of the criminalization of pro-Palestine speech at levels we have never seen before. And now we have seen the justice system being brought into it to exact out the reprisals. We have seen dozens and dozens of protesters being arrested in Toronto and elsewhere. The last count I had in Toronto, this was late 2024 was over 90 protesters or advocates who have been arrested by the Toronto police alone. These are all going into the criminal system, and many of the charges may be dropped. However, the act of being charged and having to go through that process can have, you know, a very difficult impact on a person's life. And to think that there are over 90 plus people who are being charged with very minor charge, but still being forced to go through these criminal proceedings in and of itself is a very serious concern. And, you know, around the Palestinian, you know, freedom of expression for Palestine. And we are seeing this exception on free speech play out in Canada. So this element of criminalization, is something that is concerning, and we are, you know, paying very close attention to.
I think also the symbolisms have increased, and there are new ones that came up. So that also,
yeah, we've had new symbols. Yep, watermelons. I mean, we didn't.
Yeah, watermelon's old, but there's some new stuff. Yep. Like ceasefire now, the red triangle, Hind Hall, the songs, like all these are new symbolisms. So it does make sense for the frequency to increase.
Yes, absolutely.
Here's an interesting question. So if someone is not Palestinian, but faces backlash for their Palestinian activism, is that considered APR? Because I think I've read somewhere, and maybe you can correct me on this, but part of the reason why there is a pushback on APR, the argument they're giving is that APR is not racism, it's a political stance that we're against. Was that something on that front been presented?
Yeah, I mean, we've pretty much heard it all, you know, at this point around the criticisms. But, you know, so this was a question we posed as part of the consultation process in creating the framework. I think it was almost unanimous. People responded yes. Is anti-Palestinian racism when it is, even when it's targeting a non-Palestinian. And the reason for that is that the non-Palestinian is being targeted because of their expression around Palestinian narratives, or advocacy on, you know, in favor of Palestine. So Palestine is what makes them the target. And therefore, when the person, the non-Palestinian, is being targeted for something, for advocacy work they're doing on Palestine, so the criticism that is expressed is actually about Palestine. And therefore, the trauma, the racial trauma, the harms, the impacts still impact the Palestinian community. So, for example, when Dr. Azarova at the University of Toronto, you know, she was targeted for her legal writings on upholding Palestinian human rights and criticizing Israel's treatment of Palestinians. There was an immediate visceral reaction by, you know, particularly Palestinians and Arabs in the legal profession. They took that attack personally. They felt it, you know, very much internally, because what they were saying about her and the smear campaign they did about her was essentially targeting Palestinians. So they accused her of being a terrorist supporter because she worked with Palestinian NGOs. You know, again, furthering the trope that, you know, Palestinians are, you know, either all terrorists or sympathizers of terrorism. You know, they used terminology about her advocacy, you know, that she was obsessive, that, you know, trying to paint her as anti-Semitic. Again, it's a smear that as Palestinians, we all feel that the only reason you are upholding Palestinian human rights is because you harbor some type of biblical or inherent hatred towards Jewish people, which is not true. So that impact, that treatment of her, you know, still had a harm on the community. And this is something that was expressed. This was expressed in the consultations. The other piece is that, you know, we are working for, you know, for Palestinian human rights, you know, to end the illegal occupation of Palestine as part of a movement. And it's a very diverse movement, and it's an anti-racist movement. So we have a responsibility to ensure that we each keep each other safe. If then we excluded non-Palestinians from you know, from the, you know, framework of anti-Palestinian racism, meaning that if I, as a Palestinian, say the same thing as a non-Palestinian, I am somehow protected by the framework around anti-Palestinian racism, but the person saying the same thing I did because they're non-Palestinian is not, then, you know, we are making some already vulnerable people within our movement even more vulnerable. And we need to ensure that they are protected as we are protected. Again, they are being attacked not because of who they are as a person. They're being attacked for saying and upholding Palestinian human rights, just as Palestinians are saying in upholding Palestinian human rights. The attack is on the Palestinian piece, not them as a person. So that's the part we have to uphold, because that, again, it goes back to upholding the occupation and preventing criticism of Israel's actions against Israel, which again maintains the illegal occupation. The other piece around that is that what we have seen, especially in this last period of time, but we noted it in our report, that there is sometimes a strategy to deliberately go after our allies. So, you know, you're a Palestinian, you're a lost cause. I can't tell you to stop being Palestinian. But what I'll try to do is scare your allies and break the co-solidarities forming between different movements. And the Palestinian movement has support from many different movements. So we will go after and target, for example, Angela Davis and the anti-Black racism, Black Lives Matter movement, because they speak for Palestinian human rights. So we're going to paint them and their community as being anti-Semitic, as a way to, you know, create the chill and fear there in order to try to isolate Palestinians. So it is important, and this is what we did here from the consultation, that and this is why we say it's about an attack on the Palestinian narratives, you know, to ensure that we encompass those, regardless of their identity, who speak up for Palestine and ensure that they are protected.
So what concrete policy changes are needed to address APR at a systemic level?
Built on systemic racism.
Yeah.
They're suppressing critical race theory by America. My new system, it's made for them.
So we have started the process. We are seeing that change happening very much at local levels. And I think we have to acknowledge and recognize that much of the impact of, you know, the recognition of anti-Palestinian racism has been coming from those who are directly impacted by their institution, and they are then working with that institution to hold that institution directly accountable. So one example where this has been very successful is around parents and students at different school boards. And they have been working, you know, with their school boards, and the school boards accountable to them to talk about anti-Palestinian racism. And we have seen that, we've started to see that anti-Palestinian racism is being recognized in their anti-racism strategies, sometimes with a definition, sometimes without a definition. But that recognition is important, because then it sort of opens the door for these discussions. So what we'd like to see is so that work at the local level should continue, and it's going to be even more important, because as governments change, you might have a friendly government, you might have a hostile government, you might have a very hostile government, you don't know. But doing that work with your institutions that hold you directly accountable, or who are directly accountable to you, I think is where we have been seeing the greatest gains being net. So that's, you know, student unions, again, the parent-teacher public schools, our art and cultural institutions who are doing this within their organization, faculty associations, and so on and so forth. And we want to also see that happen with unions as well. Unions, and there is a concern, especially because how much reprisals we saw over the last 15 plus months, and attacks on workers for speaking out. We want to see unions looking at collective agreements, and making sure that they include clauses that will protect people from reprisals, especially for expression that's expressed outside of the workplace, and ensure that they update their anti-racism policies to, you know, explicitly recognize anti-Palestinian racism and ensure that they continue to do educational training and awareness building in that realm. At the federal government level, we have made those gains, as we noted, within the Canadian Anti-Racism Strategy, recognizing that Palestinians are facing unprecedented levels of hate in Canada. But we want to see that formal recognition put in there to concretize this. And we hope to see, and we urgently call on the government to do this before the next federal election. You know, again, where we are seeing other forms of places of reprisals is in academia. We need academic institutions to make a commitment to uphold academic freedom on Palestine. Right now, we have seen that and heard that many institutions at the, you know, very senior level has been very hostile. But we need people to continue to push. And if the main government is hostile, then work within the other spaces within the university that are not. Usually those at the top are the last ones to follow. So, you know, to keep pressing on with the work. Within arts and cultural institutions, we want to make sure that we see, or actually before we get to arts and culture, for academia, we have to acknowledge that some of these institutions have made agreements around the encampments with students. So we want to make sure that they uphold that commitment, those commitments in good faith, in the same way that the students bargained in good faith, and that they work towards divestment. Because we have an ICJ ruling at the, you know, that finds that Israel is committing an illegal occupation, and therefore universities should take it very seriously to ensure that they are not complicit in those very serious crimes. So we want to see that divestment happening at those, you know, at the university levels. And again, with the federal government, divestment from, you know, arms embargo, military settlements, the free trade agreement, you know, any sort of multilateral partnerships with Israel, because that's where the work at the for anti-Palestinian racism starts. It starts at the very top. That's the first and foremost thing that we must do to tackle anti-Palestinian racism. It is to end the illegal occupation and apartheid of Palestine. So that's where we need to continue pushing our efforts. And then all the other pieces, you know, fall under that at the local level, institutional level. There are different levers we can push. In the arts, you know, we need to end the censorship of Palestinian arts and artists and curators. So there is something we can all do in all our spaces. This is our space. This is our environment that we have agency over, and we have institutions that are directly responsible or accountable to us. If we don't ask, the institutions are not going to just have an epiphany and you know, wake up one day and say, yes, let's tackle anti-Palestinian racism. We have to be the ones to open these conversations with our institutions and ensure that it is recognized in our anti-racism policies and our EDI work and so on and so forth. And eventually, the top will follow. They won't be the first, but eventually they will follow when this momentum builds. So, you know, we start with the occupation and then focus within our own local spaces to make sure that we end any complicity with the occupation and recognize anti-Palestinian racism within those anti-racism strategies.
Thank you for tuning into the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of CJPME and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. See you next time.
In his powerful 1984 article, Permission to Narrate, Edward Said said, "The Palestinian narrative has never been officially admitted to Israeli history, except as that of non-Jews, whose inert presence in Palestine was a nuisance to be ignored or expelled." Said used the word inert, of course, not descriptively, but to conjure up the Zionist fantasy of the ideal Palestinian body. Perhaps for the coloniser, this ideal body should be lifeless or disappeared. But given the stubborn persistence of Palestinians to remain living on their own land, they should cause as little disturbance to the colonizers as possible. Along with no displays of cultural identity, there must be no passion, no pride, no joy, no sorrow, no anger, indeed, no demonstrable emotions that might trouble their oppressors. The late Palestinian psychologist Adib Jarrah, referring to the narcissism which characterized so much Israeli discourse about Palestinians, said in 2016, "We must be the only oppressed people whose job it is to make our oppressors feel good about themselves." His words were revived when Israel issued a diktat that in the first exchanges of prisoners as part of the current Gaza ceasefire, Palestinians welcoming back their loved ones must not demonstrate any public joy or celebration. These orders were reinforced by soldiers arriving at the family homes of those about to be released. Most prisoners released in the first round were women subject to illegal carceration, and they were held until it was dark. Needless to say, they were greeted with exuberant joy by all those who waited up for their return. We should pause and ask the question, what does this attempted prohibition of public joy signify? It stands in stark contrast to the public outpouring of emotion that greeted the release of Israeli captives. It reflects narcissism, a sense of entitlement, and a belief that only the feelings of Jewish Israeli citizens matter. This is reinforced by the impunity granted to Israel by Western governments to consider only its own needs and interests. It is mirrored by mainstream media that covers the suffering of Israeli captives and their families in detail, elaborating their individual narratives, always referring to them by name, while Palestinians held in Israeli jails are mostly portrayed as an incoherent mass with individual stories rarely attached. For example, the New York Times has published extensive human interest stories about the released female Israeli soldiers, but failed to cover in any detail the detention of the heroic Dr. Hussam Abu Safia. This focus on Israeli Jewish feelings alone has been and continues to be replicated in the demand that anyone speaking about Palestinian suffering must first condemn the Hamas attacks of 7th of October 2023. That day has been subject to continual coverage on Israeli media, amplifying a sense of fear and victimhood and reinforcing a shocking indifference to the genocide being waged less than 80 kilometers from Tel Aviv. Author Naomi Klein referred to this as the weaponization of trauma, arguing that the state of shock from 7 October is maintained so that people are kept in a state of raw emotion that precludes any possibility for empathy, thoughtful analysis, guilt or shame about the genocidal campaign taking place supposedly in their name. The obverse of this hyper-emotionality is the refusal to accept that Palestinians are entitled to any emotional display and to label such displays as a threat, as destructive, as inimical to the public good. It fits with a pattern of surveillance, not only over the movement's activity and speech of Palestinians, but also over their emotions. Policing of emotions is another aspect of the deep intrusion of a settler colonial state into the subject people. For example, Palestinians held up for hours at checkpoints cannot express frustration by shouting or hooting their horns, as they will be punished. Feelings of rage and fury thus have to be suppressed. These emotional experiences are mirrored in the way that Palestinians speaking to the Western media often feel they have to measure every word so they don't come across too forcefully or emotionally and risk alienating their interviewer or conforming to colonizing tropes of the over-emotional, irrational native so well analyzed by Said in his book Orientalism. Public displays of emotion, whether joy at the release of prisoners or grief at the burial of martyrs, are policed in multiple ways. Israel has long had a practice of refusing to return the bodies of Palestinians subjected to extrajudicial killing, invariably accused of terrorism, but assassinated before they had a chance to stand trial. In these cases, the body is often held as a bargaining chip and a means of control. Former Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yalon admitted in 2015 to refusing to return the bodies of slain Palestinians unless their funerals were kept as modest family affairs held at night. He threatened that when this does not happen, we will not return them, even if it means us burying them ourselves. The distress caused to Palestinian families by having to bury their loved ones under such imposed conditions is compounded by an inability to perform Muslim burial rituals and the very poor state of a body that has been deep frozen for weeks. But expressions of distress or anger aroused by these intolerable conditions are seen by those of power only as a political threat or as promoting violence against Israelis. One of the most egregious examples of disrupting public grief took place in 2022 in occupied East Jerusalem at the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh, the renowned Al Jazeera journalist. Israeli soldiers attacked the pallbearers, almost causing her casket to fall to the ground. The fact that they saw fit to do this at the funeral of a woman, an iconic figure beloved by millions in the Arab world, and moreover killed by an Israeli soldier, indicates how little Israel and the US care about causing hurt or offence to Arab public opinion. Emotions, to quote Saeed's comment about facts, do not at all speak for themselves, but require a socially acceptable narrative to absorb, sustain, and circulate them. How emotions are narrativized is a function of power, and in a context of extreme power imbalance, only the emotions of those with power are allowed to count. Thousands of Palestinian scholars, journalists, activists, poets, and novelists have shared the historical narratives forming the contemporary Palestinian experience, and thereby placed actions and emotions, including those of the Hamas attacks of 7 October, in an explicable context. But the refusal of Israel and its defenders to connect Palestinian actions to any history or context, alongside a construction of all resistance as terrorism, is a sterile and repetitive practice of power. The obsessive need to police emotions is one such practice, ultimately a sign of weakness and vulnerability. On the first day of the Gaza ceasefire, three young Israeli women emerged from captivity into the light to expressions of joy that few would begrudge them or their families. In the middle of that night, 90 Palestinian women and children emerged from the darkness of their captivity. But they were not intended to emerge into a jubilant, joyful light. The occupying power preferred to keep them in the dark, conjuring up former Chief of Staff Rafael Eitan's vile phrase from 1982, like drugged roaches in a bottle. The attempt to suppress displays of emotion that challenge the oppressors must be seen for what it is, and always has been, a deeply racist and dehumanizing worldview. The families of the released detainees refused this dehumanization and insisted on celebrating. This can be seen as an act of resistance. However, the word resistance conveys reactivity to oppression and accords, therefore, too much power to the oppressor. Far more than resistance, it is an insistence upon the right to life, livability, and the freedom to give voice to all human emotions, whether joy, anger, sorrow, or pride.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we covered a new initiative in Canada that is trying to have a clear definition of anti-Palestinian racism be recognized officially by the Canadian government. We learned what are the reasons behind the initiative and why anti-Palestinian racism shouldn't be conflated with Islamophobia in general. In the second part of the show, we learned how even the simple display of emotions by Palestinians is constantly erased and vilified by the media. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to CKUT's website at CKUT.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find them. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at CFRC.ca. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.